Good evening, everybody. I'm Shan Creighton. I'm currently serving as the General Secretary of the American Friends Service Committee. And I'd like to start by welcoming everybody and thanking you so much for your support and your interest in the work of AFSC. This is a call that's part of a series where we offer supporters and donors and those who are interested a chance to learn more about our work, usually by speaking directly with those who are on the front lines. But this is an end-of-year call, and it's an opportunity for me to reflect with you on some of the things that I've seen as General Secretary in my travels around the work of the Service Committee, and to give you some sense of where I think we're going to be heading in the future. For those of you who are new to AFSC, and there may be a few out there, we are a Quaker organization that's been working since 1917 for a world in which all people can live in peace. And the most important thing, I think, that characterizes our work is that we understand that peace requires much more than the absence of war and physical violence. When we work for peace, we need to work for just social and economic conditions, because that is what's really necessary to sustain peace in the world. So I've been giving some thought about how to talk about the highlights of this year, and I think I'd like to try to do two brief things before I get into some of the work. I want to expand just a little bit on the history of the Service Committee and say a few words about why I think we are, despite the tragedies that have surrounded us recently, the gun violence in Newtown, Connecticut, and before that, other episodes of violence here at home and wars abroad. But despite that, I feel like we are at a moment of great opportunity for finally changing the narrative that people have been locked into about the power of war to create security, the power of force. So I want to do those two things, to give you this history and then talk about the opportunities I see, and then talk about some of the work that I've visited this year and seen for myself how we might go about changing that narrative. The Service Committee was actually formed just as the U.S. entered World War I, and it was to provide an alternative to military service, because the Quakers who formed this organization were fearful that their children, who had not seen with their own eyes the legacy of war, they had not been around to see the Civil War in our country, and that they might be seduced by patriotic war fever. They might be led to believe that you could really serve peace by serving in the military. So I think that that notion of trying to find an alternative way to serve peace is one that has stayed with us all these years. And when the young people who went to France in World War I came back, they did begin to work on what they saw as the roots of violence and war in their own country. And since the 1920s, this organization has worked on racism, on prison reform, on calling for businesses to be accountable and how they treat their employees, working for economic justice in West Virginia, and working for immigrant rights since the 1920s. We also have worked with pariah countries, places that our government has declared not okay to do business with. And in fact, our relief work in the 20s in the Soviet Union earned AFSC its first entry in our rather fast FBI file, as we were identified as possibly giving support to the communist country that was the Soviet Union then. So I would like to just say that we have been an organization that has worked for peace. And when people look back on some of our work and they talk about the work we did with the Japanese Americans who were interned after World War II, and they talk about what a great gift it was that we did that work, they sometimes forget how controversial our work was at the moment that we did it, and how much that led others to say we were not supporting the needs for security in our own country and building the platform for security that was seen to be having an enemy, fighting the enemy, using force. I would say that one of the turning points for many people at AFSC was going back to Europe after World War II and seeing the terrible destruction that that war had wrought, and realizing the destruction that comes with war is cannot possibly be a way to build peace. And as a Quaker organization, we need to bear witness to the truth and experiment and learn about how to make peace. So I think that we're doing that today, and I think that we have a moment, an opportunity that many people have not recognized, in which the messages that we have been giving to people for now more than 90 years about the power of nonviolence and alternative ways to root out the evils of injustice, these messages are actually taking hold, and we have an opportunity to make a difference. One of the things that has colored the U.S. history is that since World War II, the U.S. made a decision to stay on a permanent war footing. After World War I, we basically closed down the military. We reduced the size of the armed forces. But after World War II, we maintained an armed force that would be capable of fighting another world war. And in doing that, we were warned by Dwight D. Eisenhower that the military-industrial complex might actually have an untoward impact on some of the decisions we would make down the line. And indeed, more recent President Jimmy Carter, who's not a pacifist, but he has a rather narrow definition of what is a just war. When Jimmy Carter has looked at where we have been since World War II, almost constantly at war, he has declared that none of these really met his definition for just wars. And we have not only engaged in a lot of wars that are hard to defend, but Jimmy Carter, along with Martin Luther King and others, has realized that the cost of those wars has been to not invest in the things that would have truly led to peace, the things that would have built up our country in terms of education, in terms of disparities that have persisted since the times of slavery between black and white communities, that we could have made such a difference in our own country that we have chosen not to do that because we're paying for war. So I'm sounding pretty depressing, so why is it that I think there's an opportunity here? Well, I think that despite the fact that we have not only had this military footing since World War II, and we've armed ourselves individually since the 50s and 60s, now 90 out of 100, there are 90 guns for every 100 people in America. But despite that, there's an arc of evidence that has been building and being accepted by more and more people about the fact that there is no good war. And Europeans learned that lesson after World War II, and I think the nomination recently of the European Union to win the Nobel Prize speaks to the fact that Europe had been almost continually at war, Western Europe had been continually at war for hundreds of years. And after World War II, what they saw was that they had to find another way. They had to find a way to work together in cooperation, and that that was the answer, not to continue this fighting. The conflicts are only resolved through restorative means, without force or coercion. And we have seen, since World War II, Gandhi, the civil rights movement, even areas like business negotiations, for anybody who has read the book Getting to Yes, it was a new way of thinking about negotiation, not as trying to beat down your opponent, but just try and find out how you could meet each other's needs, so that both of your needs could be met. And the Harvard Negotiation Project that has grown out of that has gone on to work on international and other kinds of issues with great success, using the principles of peace and nonviolence. In fact, there is a growing group of scholars who have begun to study what it takes to build a culture of peace. So a professor at the University of Illinois at Chicago, Mark Mattaney, has a peace power strategy, a set of evidence-based tools for changing a culture of violence in a school or a community into a culture of peace. It's tools that are based on actual research that has been done and proven to work and is at use in 12 different states. And we see an issue in May 1912 of Science magazine that reviewed a wide range of research about social and biological factors contributing to human conflict. Swarthmore College has launched the Global Nonviolent Action Database, cataloging hundreds of nonviolent campaigns. And also in 2012, we saw the publication of Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stephan's book, a stunning book that showed the power of nonviolence, why civil resistance works. They studied 323 instances from 1900 to 2006 in which people tried to change a regime, a repressive regime, end an occupation. And what they found actually surprised them, that nonviolent civil resistance is twice as effective, even against repressive regimes. That they had a greater chance of succeeding in overthrowing a regime or ending an occupation when the techniques used were nonviolent than when they chose armed rebellion. And they also found that the regimes that were changed through nonviolence had less opportunity, were less likely to re-erupt into violence again. So I think what we're seeing right now is a moment in which the evidence, the head evidence, the intellectual evidence has been growing. And now there's some opening of our hearts as we see the tragedies that have occurred when people have been allowed to be armed, that they really are disturbed and who needed not a gun, but a voice, a helping hand, some counseling, perhaps some medication early in their life that might have changed that course. So I think what we have at this moment is an opportunity for launching a new narrative, a narrative of the truth that war is not the answer to any kind of lasting security. And I want to talk about two initiatives that AFSC is just the beginnings that build on our work from this year and talk about some work this year that exemplifies that. And the first part of this initiative is to have really powerful examples of the power of nonviolence to transform lives in schools in Los Angeles, in prisons in Maryland, among young people in Indonesia who are facing religious intolerance and violence, in Burundi, in peace villages where victims and ex-combatants are living and working side by side. And then I want to talk about the second part of this, which is how we come together at a higher level and begin to work with the media, to work with the arts, to work with academics, to build a real learning network about what we can do to create an understanding of what it takes to create true security in our world. So let me talk about some of the initiatives that we've done that really seem to make a difference in people's lives. And to talk about the fact that we have to look not just at peace as ending violence, but looking at the underlying conditions that lead to violence. And I'll talk a little bit about some work that we've done in New Mexico, where there was great food insecurity. It was the most food insecure state when we began our program there about 5 years ago. And it's a state where that need not be true, because the traditional ways of farming in that state, the ways used by the Native Americans who had been there for many centuries, did know how to use water wisely and be able to support local food growing. But at the time that we began this program, the only opportunity for many young people seemed to be military service. That men and women from the reservations, men and women from traditional families, which were traditional Hispanic families in New Mexico, are largely Native people who were Christianized in the 16th century by the Spaniards. But these people, the traditional families and the Native Americans, benefited from the Spanish land grant system that had been set up when the Spaniards were there. They gave land and water rights to people. And we were able to begin working in a poor community, working with youth in a charter school, to build a garden. And to tie that garden to not only growing food and learning how to do that in traditional ways, to build their relationship to their food, but also to tie it into learning about math and science and history and culture. That simple start was just one beginning. And it grew into support for training and the development of community gardens, including one that works with developmentally disabled adults, with families of those who've been incarcerated, with urban Native Americans, the Red Wolf Band, a tribe, not a tribe actually, but a collection of Native Americans who live in Albuquerque. And over a course of 5 years, this program, which started very small, has won a $1.5 million grant from Kellogg and was selected by Kellogg to be one of four states that could be a real example of how this kind of organic farming could take people in poverty and help them find a way out. Now, I want to say that the work required us to also find a way to connect these small farmers, because we were training people to work on very small farms, to a way to sell their produce. And so it developed a cooperative, the Agricultura Network, and that cooperative was able to teach the farmers how to package the goods so that they could win a contract with the Albuquerque school system and provide fresh, wholesome, organic, locally grown food for Albuquerque schools. So this is an example of trying to show something about the power of putting our effort and our energy not into war and coercive things, but into positive opportunities in communities. That farm work actually has spread even within AFSC. And in Los Angeles, where we were working with inner city kids at a continuation high school, which is kind of an end of the line school for kids who have been expelled or suspended, we were working in that school initially with some curricula that are developing conflict resolution skills, empathy, listening. We had the kids do a digital storytelling project where they interviewed somebody they respected in the community. And initially, this class, which was about 20 kids, most of them with gang connections, they didn't really want to look up from their books. They didn't want to work together. They were kind of dragged into working in twos and threes on the digital storytelling project. But by the end of that project and the end of that first year, having heard a little bit about the garden and the charter school in New Mexico and looking around the Mar Vista Gardens, the housing projects in which they live, they said, hey, we could build a garden here. We'd like to do a garden here. And that was a real turnaround, because these kids were not well regarded in Mar Vista Gardens. And all of a sudden, they were out there trying to get permission to get water into this little weedy patch behind the school, taking lessons on how to mulch and learning how to build raised beds. And before you know it, they had a garden out there that was so good, it won a national award, the Healthy Sprouts Award, in 2010. There were over 80 schools that had competed for school projects related to this kind of work. And these kids, who had never really done much, were suddenly able to make a contribution. And in case you think, well, it's a heartwarming story, but then what? I was just this year in Los Angeles. I was at a meeting in Los Angeles with a group of people who had been working in the LA schools about a really important issue, an initiative to try to reduce suspensions and expulsions. In California, more kids are suspended and expelled every year from high school than are graduated. And this is really the school-to-prison pipeline, especially affecting young boys and men of color, but really a problem throughout the state. And it was young people in Fresno who actually first raised this issue and started to get the attention of adults. And as a result of that, a statewide effort grew up to organize schools up and down the state to go to Sacramento and lobby for changes in the state law, to ask that instead of zero tolerance policies that resulted in kids being expelled when they had a plastic butter knife in their backpack, that some kind of restorative justice model might be used, that some kind of positive behavior reinforcement model might be used, and the teachers might get training in how to do that so that they would feel able to do those kinds of things. These kids were successful. Four bills were signed into law by Governor Brown this last year that changed some of the rules in California about schools. And the L.A. City Council changed some of their rules, in which they had the L.A. school police issuing truancy tickets inside the high schools, which is an interesting question about how that might work. And by a 14-0 vote, they began to change some of the rules they had about the way that truancies were handled in L.A. City. Now, why I'm saying this is I was in this meeting, and this young man was presenting the results of the statewide campaign that had been so successful, and I kept thinking, I've seen him before, I know him. And this turned out to be Carlos Gonzalez, who was one of the kids in that Healthy Sprouts garden in L.A., who's now been turned around and all of his friends were laughing, and they said, we call him Farmer Elmo, because everywhere he goes, not only is he organizing all this work about changing the schools, but he's trying to get us all to grow something, grow a garden. So I want to say that there's a great power beyond the individual when you work with an individual, because you could see this young man taking what he had learned and using it to transform his community. So this kind of garden work might not sound like piecework, but I believe that it is the most profound kind of piecework. Piecework that's really building the power of a community that has been forgotten, and helping to reconnect it to its ability to make a difference in not only their economic conditions, but their social conditions and to change the world around them. But it's more than that. We've also been doing farm work overseas, and I had the chance this year to visit the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, North Korea. We've been working there since the famine in the 1980s. And it's just the same kind of work that we did with the pariah state of the USSR during the famine of the 20s. When we went in the 1980s with the offers of rice, we were actually the only U.S. organization that was permitted to give aid in that famine, which I find very interesting, that this communist country would find this Quaker organization to be the one that they were willing to work with. But we had a reputation that we would give the aid, that we would not interfere, and what they said to us is, we don't really want rice. What we want is somebody who will help develop in us the capacity to grow our own food. So the program we've been doing in North Korea these years has been a program where we work in 4 township farms and have worked with the farm managers to help them experiment and improve the productive output of their land. I learned a lot about rice farming on my trip to North Korea, and it was an interesting thing for me, because I did a lot of work in the People's Republic of China in the 1980s in rural areas. And there were several things that were amazing that I didn't expect to see. One was how open North Korea was. We don't go there, so we think nobody goes there. But actually, there are European countries that are investing and doing some joint venture work there. My sense is that I was far more controlled going to China in the mid-1980s. I was far less free. They took away my passport and wouldn't let me get out of sight of a minder than I was in North Korea right now. That I was working with Linda Lewis, our Korean-speaking country director, and Melinda and I were allowed to walk by ourselves in the evening. We went on the subway. We ate in a local Korean restaurant, and we ate in a Swiss joint venture restaurant that served pizza and fondue at some point. So there was a lot going on in North Korea that I didn't expect. But one of the things that was most exciting for me was to see that we have been able to make a difference there, too. Not only have we helped them increase, just in this last round, increased the rice production 50%, we also found that the North Koreans turned to us as these joint venture projects were growing, and they said, you know, we discovered that we have a hard time talking to these business people. We don't speak the same language. We don't understand how to work with them. And they asked us to set up a program that would help them understand how Western business people think. Now, some of you may be laughing and wondering what on earth they were thinking of to ask this Quaker organization what Western business people think. But we were smart enough not to try to do this on our own. And instead, we worked with a Chinese university business school in northern China. And we helped to set up a special short mini MBA program so that some mid-level North Koreans could come out and get some training so they could understand a little better how to work effectively with some of these new efforts to open up their country, even if they weren't coming from the U.S. Well, all of that is really wonderful, and it made me feel good. But one of the best things that happened, I thought, as a result of my trip to North Korea, when I was looking around, one of the things they were working on in the North Korean farms were greenhouses. They were building greenhouses. They were trying to learn how to make them work. And I realized that our farms in New Mexico, greenhouses are the heart and soul of what they do. And that Don Bustos, our director there, knew a lot about it. And I made the suggestion that maybe Don should come to visit with the North Korean work, and maybe we should do some exchanges in that at that level. So Don went in August to North Korea, had a wonderful experience, and is now going back with some additional materials to participate in the farm training that will be done for the North Korean farmers this coming year. It's an example of a kind of person-to-person exchange, farmer-to-farmer exchange, that has really been a wonderful opportunity for us to continue this opening up of North Korea. I believe that there's lots of reasons to be skeptical about where North Korea is going to go, and one doesn't want to be naive about it. But I also think that we in the U.S. forget what the story looks like from another side, and there's usually more than one story. When I was in North Korea, they took me to see the USS Pueblo. Some of you who are old enough to remember may recall that in February 1968, the Pueblo was captured spying off the coast of North Korea. It's now a tourist attraction in Pyongyang. But the truth is that we are still at war with North Korea. We actually, as far as they are concerned, have never executed any kind of peace treaty with them. And if you think about what's gone on all these decades with Cuba, you know, the Cubans are in the same way. We still are insisting on holding back, on not really opening up, and trying to invite Cuba back into the community of nations. And indeed, the Cubans were rightly concerned, as we proved to them with the Bay of Pigs invasions and other things, that we might actually step out. So when you see the story from another side, you understand that there is a reason why, when we look, we see people taking what we call aggressive actions, but they're also seeing us doing aggressive actions too. I want to say that we really are at a point where I think we need to start changing the narrative about what we can do as a country and as individuals to help people understand that war and violence never succeed. And it's not the pacifists who are naive, because we're beginning to see evidence over and over that those who refrain from using force and violence actually have more lasting effect. And so I believe that it's time for us to begin to work with the media, to work with the arts, to work with the scientists, to work with everyone who will listen, as we have done with things like Eyes Wide Open, to bring people in to question some of the assumptions that they've had. We've bought a narrative of scarcity and fear, and that leads to conflict. And we need to look to the fact that, in fact, we live in a very abundant world, especially of those of us here in the U.S., and that we can have even more abundance if we learn how to share what we have, if we learn how to invest in our own youth, in our own future, instead of holding back and stopping that. Now, I want to say that there's lots of places where we need to look at how we can help the media to see what it needs to be done. And I'll talk just a moment about Israel-Palestine. There's a wonderful documentary that was done in 2009 by Julia Baca, Boudris, and it tells the story of a Palestinian village when the wall was being built that was going to separate the illegal settlements from the rest of Israel-Palestine. This village, the wall was going to go right between the village and the farmlands where their olive trees were. And a woman in the village, Iltiza Morar, led a very successful nonviolent effort to change the direction of the wall, completely nonviolent. This was not covered, this effort. It wasn't something that the media wanted to put out there. And Julia Baca made a wonderful documentary that really showed the power of this movement. And she also has an interesting TED Talk, Julia Baca does, if those of you who like that sort of thing, you might want to look at. And it talks about the media's fascination with the suicide bombers, with the bombing, but not with the powerful nonviolent movement that exists right now inside Palestine. If you go into Palestine, if you go into Gaza, if you are on the Palestinian side of the wall, what you see is some amazing graffiti. It's not a lot of four-letter words and characterizations of wanting to kill somebody. It's peace doves. It's a beautiful graffiti by the graffiti artist Banksy. It's really very moving to see the art that has emerged on the inside of that wall. The Palestinian Christians issued the Cairo Palestine document that was asking for support for nonviolent witness, following the example of South Africa. And there is a peace movement also inside Israel. We have a young woman in Israeli who's on our staff in Israel, and what she says with the most winning smile that you can imagine is, I'm working to help Israel become the country it intended to be. And it intended to be a country that learned from the Holocaust that there has to be peace for all, and that we have to have rights for all, and that's what we have to do. So, you know, I think that it's those kinds of people that are beginning to lead the way, and we certainly can say that all of the efforts that I've seen over the last 10 years in Israel-Palestine, the development of that wall, when I go to Palestine and Israel today, I don't see that the Israeli people feel more secure as a result of this. In fact, there seems to be more fearfulness and insecurity. Because there is this negative cycle that we have, and I believe that we really have to build on the optimism of the young people, and we hear it there too, the young Palestinians who say, we will live as we desire. You cannot take away our happiness. Our achievement knows no borders, and they work forward to see where they can go. So I believe that the tide is turning, that as scientists and authors are studying and practitioners are looking at what's possible with the power of peace, they are seeing that there really is an amazing ability to transform. And it takes courage, because when faced with someone who is threatening violence, it takes courage to say, I will not go there, that I'm willing to stand with you, but I'm not willing to fight with you. Now, Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stefan were surprised by their results when they found that nonviolent efforts to overthrow regimes were more effective than violent ones. But I'm not. And I think it comes from my experience growing up in the South. I went to high school in Ozark, Alabama in 1960, and I had I'd been living in Europe for about 7 years before that, and it was quite a shock for me to go there. But I found myself really watching the civil rights movement from a very close, and realizing the enormous power that these disciplined, loving people had as they stood for their rights. And really seeing that movement is what convinced me of the power of nonviolence. But I think that, like silence, nonviolence is fragile. It's easily broken. And you can see that in Libya. You see that in Syria. And I would like to say that there was heart-stopping power in the deeply disciplined and deeply spiritual and loving power that I saw in Selma and Birmingham in the civil rights days. That is what reached the hearts and minds of those who had previously been willing to live the lie. Václav Havel talks about what gives dictators power is people of goodwill being willing to live the lie. But the separate but equal lie could not be accepted anymore in the face of those people who were willing to face the dogs and the guns and the burning crosses, but to stand up with integrity and peace. So I'm optimistic, and I think that we're at a moment right now where the mood is changing, where we have an opportunity to move in a new direction. People's hearts are opened because they see that violence is really not getting us where we need to be. So I hope that you will join us in optimism and compassion as we move to change this narrative in the future, and know, as Arundhati Roy has said, that another world is not only possible, she's on her way. On a quiet day, I can hear her breathing. So let me stop here and see what questions you might have, and willing to address any other things that you wanted to hear about.
All right, folks, this is Ralph again. I am going to unmute the lines, and feel free to ask your questions. At some point, I will move over to the questions on email, so if you want to ask your questions via that way, Remember, the email address is ask@afsc.org. I am unmuting right now.
This is Steve Omshevsky, and you may remember meeting me at the Irwin School of Religion. I asked you about the vinyl banners that you at one time AFSC had about the a day in the Iraq War cost however much and how would you spend it. And a banner of that size was popular and was something that meetings and churches would display. And I'm wondering if there's any more stuff about that. And a second related question is that you did mention the Eyes Wide Open campaign and how effective and valuable that was. And I'm wondering if there is a similar campaign available that local groups, that Quakers could share with their communities.
Yes, actually, we have an exhibit that's traveling now, and we have the main exhibit and then a couple of smaller versions called Windows and Mirrors. And it's a very powerful exhibit about the impact of the war in Afghanistan on that community. And it's an exhibit of murals by, I believe there's about 40 murals, maybe more at this point. They show both the hope and the devastation of war. There's also part of that exhibit, some drawings from Afghan young people. And that we've got that exhibit going around. If you're interested, if you go to our webpage and look up Windows and Mirrors, there's a link where you can click in and see about getting it scheduled for someplace near you. And there are also poster size versions of some of the murals that are available for display in other places. Yes, I think banners and art are part of it. I think music and plays and stories are also part of it. Just talking, listening is part of it too. I think one of the things that troubles me in the wake of the Newtown tragedy is that we can't afford to exploit this, even though I'm very much anxious to see there be some change in our gun control laws. I want this to be an opportunity to invite people in to seeing an alternative to guns as a way of creating a safe society, not to drive them out by being accusative. And, you know, I've seen some things that I think really probably aren't productive in that vein.
I have a comment.
Mm-hmm.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, this is David Fink from Illinois Yearly Meeting. We appreciated your being with us last year, and I personally appreciate the inspiration that you've given us tonight. When you mention the civil rights movement, it brings back memories for me, including when I was doing voter registration under AFSC sponsorship in West Tennessee, summer of 1962. But I'm right now remembering that you did some very important work long before you or I were part of AFSC. When Martin Luther King was arrested and spending time in Birmingham jail, if I got the story right, it was AFSC that put his letter from the Birmingham jail into print. I think it was called at that time Untimely and Unwise. But I hope that you continue to look for opportunities to publicize how active nonviolence works and getting the message out in all the different media that we have. Your mention of Mark Mattiney's work is particularly close to my heart. He has been active in Illinois Yearly Meeting and gave a talk that I think you probably heard. So if you can put on your website how people can follow his research, that would be helpful also. Thank you, Shasha.
Actually, we're planning a gathering in the summer to build a. I've been in meetings with Mark Mattiney and also Erica Chenoweth, and we're trying to build learning networks of practitioners and academics who have particular interests in trying to understand and strengthen the practice of nonviolence in different places. Mark is, of course, interested in cultures of peace in schools and communities, and Erica is very interested in trying to understand more about the kind of political level of nonviolent activism and how that works, trying to understand why it is that nonviolence is so successful. And she has some ideas that are really quite interesting for research that she wants to continue to do. So we are trying to pursue that. And there will be links. If you haven't found our afsc.org/friends website, it's a blog there called Acting in Faith, where we have a lot of resources that we'll be putting up. We have guest bloggers from time to time, and you may see something from Mark in the future.
Can I make a comment, please?
Yes.
I'm Bashir Ahmed. I'm calling from Dayton, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
I am with the Dayton International Peace Museum. It is the only such museum in the entire United States. I am one of the board members and also the head of operations. It was interesting to hear you talk about war is not the answer, that some of the things that we are promoting at the museum, as well as creating a culture of peace. Also, that peace power strategies are twice as effective than the violence-related strategies. I am also involved as part of my international peace work in conflict zone of Kashmir. Have you heard of that?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
Yes.
But, you know, they've had this 20 years of violence, and this is my second year. For 2 years, we celebrated the International Day of Peace, September 21, and I am trying to promote peace in Kashmir through nonviolence. What would help me would be some peace power strategies. You know, you mentioned about University of Chicago. You also mentioned about two ladies. They had used some strategies.
I would say that the peace power strategy is a particular set of tools for use in mostly in schools and communities, the smaller communities, not so much about political issues like Kashmir. The book, Why Civil Resistance Works, by Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stefan, does have the first part of the street is there a statistical analysis of some things, but they also have deep case studies of some of the cases that work. I'd also recommend books by, almost any book, by Gene Sharp, who's really somebody who's done a lot of work on how to do kind of political nonviolence effectively. One of the things that Kenneth and Stefan say is that one of the reasons nonviolence is able to be more powerful is that everybody can join a nonviolent movement.
Right.
It doesn't take the same level of commitment as it does to take up arms and head to the hills and become a guerrilla soldier. And that you can actually get women and children and the elderly, the infirm, everyone out there.
Yeah.
And the power is really in numbers. It's in the community coming together.
Yes.
And that is what works.
Can I get your name again, please? I missed the conference call in the beginning.
I'm Shan, Shan Creighton, Creighton.
Oh, yeah. Of course. Okay. So our strategy is not political. It is peace-based, and we are starting with the grassroots, right from high schools. I go and lecture in the high schools, and then get them together for that September 21, Peace One Day, International Day of Peace. We're trying to stay away from the political aspect of it. My theory is that if I can get more and more people, say maybe 100,000 people, the children, the women, the parents, the teachers, in a peace march, that it can be caught all over the world, then we are basically seeking peace.
Well, let me tell you something that we've done at AFSC in Indonesia this past couple of years that's been very successful. Maybe it will inspire you. We were working in Indonesia after the tsunami, and we have worked in all across Indonesia, in Aceh, which is a largely Muslim state, and in West Timor, which is mostly Christian.
Right.
And there's been a lot, an upsurge of the religiously based violence in Indonesia, and we've been working with young Christian kids mostly in West Timor. And these kids seeing that an Easter Day parade was coming, and they were really afraid that there was going to be violence. And they had been reaching out to work with some of the other kids in the community who were not Christian. And they got the idea that they would build a peace torch out of brass and copper, very beautiful, light it, and have an imam and a priest carry it at the head of the Easter parade. We helped them to produce this in Yogyakarta and sent it out to West Timor. It was phenomenally successful. And these young people became kind of folk heroes locally. They had their faces on billboards. They were asked to come in and help with disputes. And the Peace Torch became so popular that it was asked, other cities in Indonesia asked to have it and to organize parades around it. So we've now had it in Yogyakarta, it's gone to Aceh. We're actually thinking of bringing it to the U.S. to work in one of the communities where we've worked on Islamophobia and trying to reduce...
Right, I'm involved in that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so you might think about something, something like that that's a symbol can sometimes really hold with people and
you know, the uniqueness about this Kashmiri situation is that, you know, there's no... there is basically 99% Muslims in Kashmir Valley. It is the million Indian occupation forces which is so oppressive. And you said in your talk earlier that some of these techniques can work against the oppressive regime.
Right.
And what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to change the mindset of the people, not that just the children, but adults also, to start thinking in terms of peace rather than violence.
Well, seeing you're already a partner in my movement to change the narrative, I'm delighted to have that. I'm aware there may be others who have a question on. I want to make sure that...
That's fine. Thank you. We'll be in touch.
Any other questions out there or comments?
I'm wondering, this is Tom Simpson in Saratoga Springs, New York, Saratoga Fair Meeting. I taught in the Middle East at the American University of Cairo many, many years ago. I have had the Middle East at my heart for a long time. I'm wondering about the role of the schools at in the Middle East, the Ramallah Friends School, for example, whether there is room there at the academic level, whether at any level, including university level, for research on the sharing of resources, water resources in particular. Is that a path which is in some way being followed?
Actually, I think you might want to be in touch with Ramallah Friends Center.
Yeah.
And see whether that's something that's going on there. We do work in the West Bank, and we do work collaboratively with Ramallah Friends Center from time to time. We actually have mostly done a program with Palestinian youth that are not part of Ramallah Friends School. And the school does some wonderful work, and I had the experience in Los Angeles a few years ago at a concert. A Middle Eastern a singer was performing at UCLA, and I was sitting in a row with a bunch of Arab American friends and colleagues, and one gentleman came up to me and introduced himself and asked who I was, and I said I worked for AFSC, and he said, "Oh, AFSC, the Quakers. I'm a Quaker Muslim. I went to Ramallah Boys School." It's definitely a wonderful organization, and we're happy to be in partnership. But you might want to check with Ramallah Friends Center. I think that might be more in their vein.
This is Ralph here. I just want to take one moment to ask a question from email.
Okay.
So do you have a moment here?
Yeah.
So Rick Fellows asked, AFSC at some point did a lot of work with the organization NARMIC, NARMIC, back in the 70s around alternatives to military service for high school. So he's interested in wanting to know what are we doing now, as it seems that recruits are having their way with our teams. It's a big part of global tension and conflicts that we all face.
NARMIC was a time when AFSC did more research, and I think maybe we're moving into a slightly different model for that, but I am trying very much to develop relationships with the academic community that can help us to carry out some and apply some research. As I mentioned, the idea of learning networks between academics and practitioners that we're beginning to launch here. In terms of the military recruitment, there was quite a lot of work that was done as the Iraq War and Afghanistan War built up around military recruiting. And I think that has not been a major focus of new work, but I believe that we still have a number of places where materials are distributed, and that's a place where we've often worked very successfully with volunteers. So we have a lot of materials about the truth in recruiting and questions to ask recruiters, and when we can work in partnership with teachers who are in the schools, it's been very effective. So I know in Los Angeles, the LA Teachers Union, the UTLA, United Teachers Los Angeles, had a social concerns committee that that was very helpful for us in flagging when there were abuses, when the military was in the classroom actually teaching classes, not, we were being invited in by teachers to do social studies classes and so on. So I think there's a lot of opportunity, and as we look at what we're doing to change the narrative, I hope that one of the narratives we will change and we will really take on is this idea that a young person can join the military as a way of creating a better future for themselves. And there was some comment that I heard recently, and I won't remember to whom I should attribute it, but it's kind of sad when we're a nation that has the courage to send our young people off to pointless wars, but we don't have the courage to ask people to wear a sweater and turn down the heat. I really think that the evidence has been coming out around the number of returning vets who have depression, PTSD, brain injury, traumatic brain injuries from being exposed to explosives. I was raised in a military family. My father fought in World War II in Korea, and I know that my father, on his deathbed, was still reliving things that happened to him in war. And it's a very high price for a young person to pay to get out of poverty, to ask that the only thing they can do is join the military. And I believe that that will have to be a part of any strategy to begin to change that narrative.
Thank you. Are there other questions on the phone line?
I have a comment, if that's all right.
Yeah.
My name is William Goldsby, and I'm from Selma, Alabama, and participated in quite a few of the American Friends Service committees back in the late 80s and the mid-90s. And during that period, the Community Relations Division nationally supported and funded a feasibility study that is now called Reconstruction Incorporated. Mm-hmm. And the purpose of that organization was to address violent offenders and to help them reintegrate back into the community.
Mm-hmm.
Since that time, Reconstruction has evolved and have created a curriculum that we believe at its core is a new justice paradigm. And the comment that I would like to make is within that new justice paradigm that we're working towards, and we're working with young people who are in the midst of destroying themselves through drug addiction and or violence and ending up being a part of this 2.3 million people that's incarcerated, most of it young African Americans. And we are in that situation because of, and this is my comment, the war on drugs and the war on crime that Nixon declared in inner city USA is a war within itself. It's a war within itself. And though I applaud all of the programs that we are talking about to look at war on the obvious level, but the effect of that war throughout this country is amazing. And our solution to that is to begin, and our program looks at how do we not alienate people from classrooms, people from the family, or people from whatever community, and show these families how to work with that person rather than pick that person out of the family. And I believe that is a peace model.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
I hope you will maybe send to ask@afsc.org how we could get in touch, because I'd love to see your curriculum and to pass it on. Actually, I didn't talk about some of the work that we do that's exactly in that vein. Michelle Alexander's book is really a powerful indictment of this, the war on drugs, the war on poverty, exactly the paradigms that we have to change the thinking about, because what that has been is really a war on communities, communities of color. It's the other, we are doing work in New Orleans, and I just was looking at a proposal for some new work to start in Atlanta. That's exactly looking at some of the school-to-prison pipeline issues and trying to get kids out of that. One of our big focuses in the coming years is going to be to focus on youth who are at risk, youth who have been in communities where they have not had what they need to succeed, and help them come around, as my friend Carlos Gonzalez did, to become a part of the solution, to become a part of the building of new opportunities, because the young people have it in them to do that, and we've really got to bring them along and give them the skills and the support they need. But thank you for your work, and it's wonderful to hear that seeds that were planted in the 80s and 90s are growing strong, and I hope that we can share, have a discussion, because we are trying to build the curriculum that we have around that work.
And actually, is this Mr. Goldsby?
Yes.
Hi, it's Ralph.
Hi, Ralph. Hey, young brother, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you, sir?
Oh, that's one of my mentees that you got.
Well, I know that you do good work here.
Yeah. So I definitely have your information, so I'll make sure it's passed along.
Yeah, one last thing. The book that recently got published was put on the bookstores on November the 1st and addressed some of the issues that Michelle raises. It's within that email that I sent, Reconstructing Rage, and I will be happy to continue this discussion.
Wonderful. It's great to hear you and to meet you by phone. I hope we'll meet in person soon.
Likewise.
Can I make a comment?
Sure.
This is David Hartzell from San Francisco, and thank you, Shan, for sharing some of the really exciting programs that AFSC is doing around the world in the way of nonviolence. And I guess I would like to echo what David Fink suggested earlier, that if there were on the AFSC website an area where you could have resources and projects using active nonviolence, which I think could just be very encouraging to people that are just wondering, can we make change and are there alternatives to violence and war? And there are films like A Force More Powerful, Bringing Down a Dictator, Orange Revolution, and that you mentioned Gene Sharp. There's a new film called How to Make a Revolution, which is available. But if many of those resources could be made available that communities and schools and churches, libraries, friends meetings could show to people and then perhaps have discussion and reflect on what people in other parts of the world or even in their own country have done, and perhaps get inspired to do likewise.
David, I'm completely with you about wanting to do that, but I'm not willing any longer to just put something on the website and think it might work. So what I am trying to do, and this has been a project that's taken us a little longer than because of that, is how do we not only put the stuff out there, but engage the volunteers and the people who are interested to partner to see that it really gets in the right hands and something happens with it.
Mm-hmm.
Through our Quaker connections, we're trying to work with Quaker meetings through meeting liaisons to begin to get them interested in taking on some of those things. As we're looking at how we're going to move our work forward, I think a big question for us, we're really a small organization, and our power comes from the partnerships we can develop with others and the degree to which we can link others to the resources they need. So this has got to be a powerful part of our strategy as we move forward. And I look forward to working with you, because I know that you are exactly one of the people who is able to really play that role for us. So.
Well, thank you. And I agree. The resources by themselves are certainly not enough. but if everyone in AFSC saw it as part of their responsibility to help connect people with these resources and these stories. It would certainly be helpful.
Hello? Hello, I'm Hussein. I got a break from the work. Can I get 10 minutes to speak?
Sure. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I have a question. I was trying to participate at the conference, but I was at the job, so I get 10 minutes break. I want to say some words, and then I want to listen to the recordings after I get off the job.
Okay.
Yeah, okay, thank you. I want to greet everybody who has participated in the conference.
Thank you.
Can I continue?
Sure.
Yeah, I am Hussein Mahmoud. I am from Kenya. Especially, I'm Somali by nationality. I was trained by FSC in 2009-2010 when I was in Kenya in a refugee camp in northern Kenya. I was 1 year old when my family fled from Somalia. We just grew up in conflict and stability, but FSC changed our lives through all the way from the United States. They give us training 3 months, they give us certification, and then we had a youth group, which are like 300 youth who are trained by FSC, American Friendly Service Committee. We used to work camera through making peace, through using camera. So I really appreciate the good work for the American Friendly Service Committee internationally. And I'm in the United States now for 6 months. I am in Nashville, Tennessee. So I really appreciate this wonderful conference, and I'm really glad the global work of AVC.
Well, thank you so much for telling your story, and I hope that while you're here in the U.S., maybe you can visit us in Philadelphia. I'd love to have a chance to meet you.
Yeah, absolutely. I was trying to participate in the workshop for the all, but I am at work now. I get 10 minutes break, but I really appreciate, I really remember the Kenyans and the work of AVC. I have the certificate even at home. It really changed the mind of the refugees. And the 3 month workshop facilitated by AVC and in cooperation with FreeMade and UNHCR, it really changed totally the mind of the youth and the Kodak community, which is like 550,000 refugees in Kenya. So AVC, when I came to the United States, that's why I look after AVC, and then I take it from their offices, and that's why I'm in the conference today. I'm only 21, and you can imagine how FSC reached in Kenya, which is like refugees who are not allowed to move beyond the camps. And I was in the refugee camp for 20 years. My family is still in the camp. They're coming to Nashville. But I'm really hope to get another Somalis and my community who are here to be trained by FSC as well when Somali get peace. FSC work is really, really sustaining the lives of the refugees and the vulnerable people internationally.
Well, thank you, and we will certainly look into ways that we can continue to work with you, and we appreciate your speaking up today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Aware that we have overrun the time that we had actually allotted, and I know this is a busy time of year for many people, so I don't want to keep you on too long.
And remember, you can forward your information at info@afsc.org if you want to hear the conversation. And everybody, again, thank you for joining the program update call this month. This is our year in review call that we do every year, once a chance. We'll have more updates if you visit afsc.org/program updates. You can find out about more program updates in the future. And definitely check out afsc.org for a lot of the stories that Shan talked about today. You can find on our homepage.
Ma'am.
Thank you. My name is Valerie. I've been a monthly. I'm from the Washington, D.C. area. But I'm speaking from Massachusetts, where we have our Christmas home. I've been a monthly supporter for a while now, and I've never joined on one of these calls, so please excuse me if I don't understand the format very well. I appreciate the invite to the call and the rundown on the work of AFSC. But I'm new, and I figured I'd better get involved. Resources are short for both families and AFSC. I have a process question. How do you decide, just briefly?
Go ahead.
Wow, I'm feeling kind of tread upon here. The process question is, how do you decide, Shan, how does the group decide which projects to take and which to reject?
We just went through a process of trying to develop a strategic plan for our work for the next time. And what that did was for us to take stock of our own strengths, some of the work that we're doing that is out there, what we saw as some of the needs in the world. And that was when we developed two thoughts about where we want to focus, and that is to work with youth, especially youth who are in places that are beset by violence, and that has made them vulnerable, youth that are in, and that could be in the U.S., it could be abroad, and also to do work on this narrative to really lift up a different way of thinking about problem solving, that everything doesn't have to turn into a war on drugs, a war on Afghanistan, a war on Iran. So that was a decision about a high-level focus. But the real answer to this is we have eight regions around the world, and we try to look in each of those regions and have locally based groups that are connected to the issues there that really identify how we can have the most impact in that particular region. So in Africa, for example, we work in Kenya, Somalia, as you heard, also Burundi and Zimbabwe. But one of the things that our Africa work has lifted up is a decision that we can really do a lot in working on healing and restorative processes after conflict. That we have a lot of, and we have brought together not just the countries where we physically actively work, but we've been able to bring together leaders from many African countries, for example, to help the Burundi government when they were about to have an election understand what they could do to reduce the chance of election violence. So we'll make decisions based on what we see as some strengths that we have due to our ability, and then what are some of the local needs. So in the South region in the U.S., a lot of the work that we're now looking at doing in the South really does talk about school-to-prison pipelines and talk about some of the restorative justice issues that are affecting communities there. It looks different in the West, and especially along the border, where maybe there's more of a focus on some of the immigration issues that have been created there. And what we try to do is we have our principles about how we work, and we have a real desire to create models of something that can be taken up and used elsewhere. And an example of how that's worked in the past, many, many years ago, we started something called Self-Help Enterprises here in Philadelphia, helping families have a home by participating in building each other's homes. That got taken out to California. It was spun off to be its own small, still existing organization, Self-Help Enterprises in California, that also inspired the creation of Habitat for Humanity. So, you know, that's to us a great example of trying to find a model to use it, to promote it, and then to have it spin out and go into some other greater sphere.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Well, thank you guys for joining the call. So thank you, and join us next month for our next program of Day Call. Have a great evening and happy holidays.
Happy holidays, everyone.